And I think in that sense, you know, if the question is, do I hang and display everything that I've just finished or everything that I've made? No, sometimes you want to keep things. You want to keep things because they're still part of your learning experience. They're still part of something that's triggered something in you. Hello and welcome to Art Juice. This is honest, generous and humorous conversations that will feed your creative soul and get you thinking with me, Alice Sheridan.
And me, Louise Fletcher.
So here we are. It's episode 124. And didn't talk to you last week because I was talking with Kelly. How was that?
It was a very good episode. I enjoyed it. It was nice to hear someone else who's a bit like me. She was like, so then I had an idea and then I did it in 2 weeks and then I launched it and I felt like I'd found a kindred spirit, but I really enjoyed the conversation and it's really nice. I like chatting to you and I missed having our chat, but it's nice when it comes out and I don't know what's being said. And it's a podcast to listen to because I don't have enough good podcasts to listen to. So I enjoyed it.
Oh, there's some really good ones. We were talking this week as well about the Great Women Artists podcast. Do you listen to that one ever?
Yeah, that one.
Oh, there's some really good interviews on there. There's a good one to go and find with Katie Hessel.
Oh, okay. Don't know that one.
Good. So other than that then, what have you been working on this week?
Quickly checks notes because can't remember. this week I've had a few meetings with my publisher. Because in July, we are doing a month of pre-sales where I'm selling signed copies. Because, of course, you have to sell signed copies in advance because you have to know how many copies you have to sign and then you have to go and sign them. So for the month of July, we're having promotion for the signed copies, and then we'll have another round of promotion when the book's published in October. So I had meetings with the publishers and the different people who work there this week and last week, and really I'm really thrilled with the things they're putting together for the book. Just like beautiful video that they're going to make, and just they've got a whole social media plan laid out and it makes total sense. It's like structured and organized in a good way, so I can follow that same social media plan on my accounts, but that's for their accounts obviously, and they've got a trade marketing plan. And so that was great, and it's really nice, again we've said this before, but really nice to work with people who are experts in what they do. And you're just collaborating rather than, and I do like being in charge and just making things happen, but I also do like it sometimes when I don't think I like being in a team of people where everyone's got an equal say. I think I like being the boss, but when it's like a collaborative, this is different. I can't think of why it's different, but because they've all got different expertise and things I can't do. So it's very nice, instead of me thinking, what would this video look like, to have somebody come to you with a storyboard of a video with all the slides and everything done and show you what it's going to look like. That's just really lovely. So I've been doing that. And in conjunction with that, I started, well, by the time people listen to this, I'll be towards the end of my free course, but I've started it today as we're recording, is the first lesson gone out. So I've been welcoming people in, getting my team all organized with what they're doing, technical training, etc., because we're using some new technology this year. And it's just fabulous. Only thing is, and this is a really quick beef, but I use a software for my course called Kajabi. If anybody listening also uses Kajabi, just know that on the regular plan that I'm on, they have a limit of 20,000 contacts. And then you have to upgrade if you want more than 20,000 contacts. And I've used it for mailing people on my free course 2 years running. So at the point where I reached 20,000 contacts, they didn't message me to tell me to upgrade. They didn't put a flashing thing on my account when I logged in. They just started deleting contacts. So thankfully, my wonderful assistant picked up on this and saw it before the first lesson went out and spoke to Kajabi without even bothering me because she's amazing, and found out the answer. And they said, oh, that's probably what's happening. And she's managed to re-upload 4,000 contacts who should be there. So they were showing us having filled out the form, but they were not showing, they were not receiving emails. So we've managed to fix that. But this is just technology for you. Like, I had no idea. And it was a simple click a button and upgrade. That's all I needed to do.
That's surprising, because usually these software people are right on it when you hit a level and they're like, okay, you need to give us some more money now.
I know. Unbelievable anyway. So, or sometimes what they do is they charge you, like MailChimp charges you an extortionate amount if you're going over your plan and you have to upgrade. But they didn't even do that. They just started whacking people off my account.
Wow.
So I'm going to complain about that to Kajabi, but if anyone else uses it, just be aware. So that was my week. What about you? What have you been doing?
Well, I've had I've had a nice week, actually. It's been quite a chilled out week, apart from then I had a message halfway through from David Mankin, who's a Cornish artist. And he said, you might not know about this, but there's this dodgy Russian Instagram site, and its Instagram account and website is full of your work and my work and a few other people's work that we then recognized. And so we had a kind of quite a fun day calling them out on it. And thank you for anybody who's listening who messaged. But they're really sneaky, because what they do is they blocked you. So they blocked me. So I can't find their account. I could only see it by accessing it from my daughter's phone. But because they've blocked me, I can't block them, because I can't access them in order to block them seeing what I post. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So they're sneaky, sneaky little things.
Yeah.
And yeah, basically then they've got an entire website that is populated with everybody else's images, which I've got a couple of lovely followers who speak Russian, and they wrote and they basically said, this is what they're saying. They're saying, yeah, all the copy, none of these are original. All the paintings belong to other artists. The copyright stays with them, but we can do a copy for you.
We can paint a copy.
We can paint a copy. So, it's the sheer kind of blatant, even statement of, we don't have the copyright of these, but we'll do you a copy, is actually kind of quite amusing in a way. I'm almost tempted to order one
just to see what it's like,
just to see what it looks like. But it's a really funny website, because it seems like there isn't even a place to order or contact them. So a little bit of me just wonders if there is no copying going on, no copy paintings going on. It's either just some visual front for some other fraudulent activity, or anyway, I can't really be bothered to spend that much time thinking about it. But lots of people get very upset, but I just kind of think, well, do you know what, if somebody orders some dodgy copy off a weird Russian website, it's no skin off my nose, you know.
It really
doesn't. And people have been asking, you know, this week about, you should you be putting watermarks on images. No, can't be bothered. You know,
I had a video rant about that on YouTube, because I think watermarks, not only is it a pain to put them on, but I think they put a barrier between the person looking at the art and you.
Yeah.
And after I said that on YouTube, a lady sent me an email and said, I'm leaving all your groups and social media accounts, because after seeing the nonsense you spouted about watermarks, I believe you have nothing of value to teach me. But I really believe it. I think it's absolutely,
and
yes, you will get ripped off occasionally. Yep. Yes. But like you say, does it affect you? Were those people ever going to come and buy an original painting from you? If they were going to do that, they'd come and do it. They wouldn't buy the copy.
And also the other thing about watermarks, like you say, it's a whole pain for you. But, you know, if you're uploading the images that you should be uploading, like, nobody can take one of your images off Instagram and do a print of it, because the resolution's not there. You shouldn't be putting high resolution images on your website images anyway. So if you just go through the normal practice, you know, you should be fine. Yes, somebody can do a visual copy painting. But you know what? Even I wouldn't be able to copy one of my paintings, let alone anybody else copy it visually. So good luck with that. And also, even if you did put a watermark on, software exists that takes it off again.
Yeah.
So, you know, if somebody's really determined, they're going to. But I agree with you totally. Like, if you put images on Pinterest and they're covered with watermarks, no one's going to reshare them. So at the end of the day, it's not worth worrying about. So, yeah, that's been, it hasn't been my week. That was, but possibly it's the only thing vaguely of interest that's worth mentioning.
Ellis lives an exciting life, everybody.
Well, I don't want to go. We've had the new members come into the membership, but I don't want to go on about that because it's closed now. But it's the only thing that I will say about that is lovely. And I think I'm going to say it from this point of view of encouraging people who are at the beginning of building something, anything, whether that's people who are creating a course or starting artwork new for the first time. When you start something, anything, like I did this membership, you don't know where it's going to go. The reality is you also don't know how much hard work it's going to take, how much you're going to put into it, how many times you're going to do things without direct rewards because you believe in it and you keep going. And what has been lovely this time is just things like people coming in and saying, do you know what? This is so well laid out. The content in here is just mind-blowing. It's just really lovely to feel like maybe I can just breathe a little bit now. But it's lovely to get that kind of recognition of all of those hard work and struggles and trials and doing things. And it's true in other regards too. You know, you just start something, you never know where it's going to lead, and you've just got to do whatever you need to do to keep going until you, everyone else catches up with you, basically. So we're going to talk this week. This was a listener question that came in from Sarah, and she says this: I'm coming to the end of my first solo exhibition, and from 49 paintings hung, two sold, one large and one medium size. I framed most of the pieces, although some were unframed, which allowed a range in prices, and I thought that this would fit a wider audience. Do you believe less is more when exhibiting? And this question came through to you, so I don't know her work, but we thought this would be an interesting point about less is more and how you choose work, really.
Yeah, because Sarah did actually send a photograph, but because of Instagram's direct messages are so full on my phone, when I went back to try and find the photograph, I can't find it now. She sent a photograph of her exhibition, and the so imagine there were a lot of images. They all looked beautifully framed. They were hung very close together. So a bit like the RA Summer Show, mm-hmm. You know, they were just all... the wall was full of paintings. And so that was her question, was her specific question was, when exhibiting in real life like that, should she have shown less? But it also applies, doesn't it, to online, to anything that we do, to anywhere that we show our work. Do we show everything in the hopes that somebody will find what they like in everything we've ever done, or do we curate and get really selective about what we share and select only what we feel is our very best work and give every piece space? And that applies, as I say, on your website. Or so on my website, when I did the new website, I was very selective. Mm-hmm. And I put everything, either took things off if I don't and no longer want them to be shown, or put them in an archive of past work. And then I've been really selective about what's on there, and I'll continue to be now, because I've come to the conclusion that telling a coherent story is more important than showing everything. But the one thing I did want to say about this is we've all had this experience where when you do hang everything for, say, open studios, people come along and buy the things you would have not hung if you were curating.
Yeah.
And the things you would have hung, they leave them. So what do you think?
Well, I remember the first time that I ever showed at an art fair, and I was worried about it. I didn't know. I had no idea what would sell and what wouldn't, or how I would even judge that in advance. So I basically did similar, and I basically took everything that I had, and I did have a sort of hanging plan, but my aim was to get it all on the wall. Like to put it all up there and fit it all in. I don't think I've still got any photographs, but it was pretty packed. It was a pretty packed in thing. And I thought, well, if somebody's interested, they will stand and look, and they will work it out, and they'll find the one that they like. And it looked a little bit of a mess, if I'm honest. And I think it just makes it harder for people. And I think particularly it's a slightly different situation if you're at an exhibition and you've got just your space and it's just your work within a room. But certainly at an art fair, when people are walking past multiple booths and displays, and particularly other gallery displays where they've got multiple artists in one space, it can be a real visual onslaught. And I don't think you do yourself any favors when you make it hard for people to see things clearly. And I think a lot of what people like is they like to be a little bit directed. You know, it's very much like you were saying about collaborating with the publishers for the book, and about how nice it is when somebody else has laid something out for you. It makes it easy for you to say, oh yeah, that's good, do that. Like,
yeah.
Do the same thing with your artwork. Lay it out for people clearly so that they can say, oh yeah, these pieces look great. Great. There's six paintings here. Which one would you like to choose? That's a much easier decision than here's 49, sort through them all and work out which one you like.
Yes. And my impression when I looked at Sarah's paintings, and now I can't remember, I know there were some florals. I think there were different subjects. Mm-hmm. They were quite colourful as well. So when you walk up to a wall of things that are all colourful but all different, like you say, how do you choose? And I'm thinking of those booths in an art fair that you described. And I'm thinking of, as you walk round, when somebody's put together a really coherent story about their work, and that just means a coherent display of things that seem to fit together with enough space around them for you to see them, the person next door looks different if they've done the same. And so you get a real sense of, oh, I'm walking past Alice Sheridan's booth. That looks interesting. The next person over, that doesn't look as interesting to me. But if both of you have this and that and a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of the other, I don't know, you both might look interesting, but then I look at the walls and I can't decide. There's so much to look at, it doesn't actually, story always feels like a funny word to use about paintings, but I do think it is that. It's just like in a painting, if you have a really busy painting with all sorts going on, texture and bright color and strong value contrast, and everything's happening in every space on the painting, unless your painting is about chaos and busyness, you want to start making some decisions about where to quiet it down and what do you want people to feel or think or see when they look at your painting. I think it's the same when you display your work. What do you want people to see, yeah, or think or feel?
Yeah. And I'm not even sure initially at that point that it is even about a coherence of story. For me, having been as a viewer to lots of these things, so much of it is purely about that visual onslaught. It just makes me feel tired as a visitor, and when I'm tired, I'm not going to be engaged. So I think if we come to your space or your exhibition and you've done some of the work for us by making those choices and laying it out and displaying it well, then I'm much more likely to go, oh, this looks good, let's have a look here. But maybe this was an individual. So is the question here, because what we don't know from this is if these...
It was a solo exhibition that she
okay.
had.
So was it that 40, because it may be that 49 paintings had already been curated and edited down, or was it this fear factor of I must include everything just in case somebody likes one of the ones that I might edit out? I mean, I just think to have an exhibition, a space where you've got a solo exhibition of your work like that is a lovely thing to be able to have. And you want to use it to show the best of what you do. And that sort of is not, almost by its very nature, is not going to be everything. You know, so you've got to have some degree of curation. Also, I didn't see the image, but so was it a lot of different subjects and styles as well?
The style, it seemed fairly cohesive to me in style, in the sense that, like I say, a lot of saturated colour, a lot of visual impact when you looked at it. I'm so sorry, Sarah, that I couldn't find it again. I just, Instagram direct messages are a nightmare for me to find anything in. But there did seem to be different subject matter.
Yeah.
So there definitely, I seem to recall that there was a variety. My impression when I looked at it was, wow, that's a lot of paintings on one wall.
Okay.
It like I say, like the RA summer show, where you really have to stand there and take the time to look at everything because they're all piled on the same wall. And It didn't look awful by any means, but it made me wonder if those were spaced out all evenly, like hung on an even level, because they were like a gallery wall. But if they were all hung on an even level and there was a space between each one, and say they were all florals, would people then choose more paintings because they could see them and because they'd come into the gallery or exhibition space because they like floral paintings and now they were really interested? It's difficult though, because like I say, the flip side of that is I have had open studios where, because I had a lot of space, I did put out pretty much everything the first time. And I tried to group them in different rooms so that the room worked, but the work was different in each room. And I remember clearly that the first three paintings that sold, I went, really? Like, they were literally ones that I did like them, but they felt really raw. And I was planning, if those don't sell, I'm going to paint over those. It was a really big lesson to me that we don't always know what's our best work, because they did feel exciting to me, but they felt too raw, too basic somehow.
But I think open studios is a very different situation, isn't it? Open studios, you do have that ability, if you like, to have a kind of two-tier level of work. You've got the ones that you've chosen to hang and display, and you have got others, whether they're older pieces or pieces that still feel in progress, to have available so that people can kind of see and discover them a little bit. But an exhibition is very different. An exhibition, you do want, I think, you do need to be able to curate it. And that's why curators exist, you know, because they're looking for that. They're looking for what is the story and actually how they lead people through. So whether it's a break in rhythm, like you have in a film, you know, you might have certain pieces in your exhibition that are a little bit pivot pieces, a little bit of crescendo. Then you have other pieces that are going to be a bit smaller. You can group things together in a gallery wall, but I think you need to have that sort of breathing space and rhythm. So it can be quite difficult to do for yourself. So getting somebody else involved is a really good idea to help you do it.
Yes. The only time I had a solo show, which was quite a small space, a small gallery, and there was no help. So the gallery owner said, here's the key, you know, go hang your paintings. And I found that very challenging. I did curate and I did feel happy with it in the end, but it was a real challenge. And I kept moving things. I was there all day, just moving things around, trying to get that sense. And it was like making a giant painting. Mm. Oh no, there's too much over here and not enough impact over here, but then, you know, this one's too loud and that one's too quiet, and just that sense. And then which ones are not going to get hung, that was, you know, difficult to carry them off again like little abandoned babies. One thing I did do that some of the ones that I wasn't so sure about, and particularly the ones on paper, instead of getting them framed, I put them in mounts and cellophane and then put them in a rack
so that
there was something. And I'm still not sure about that. Part of me felt like it cheapened everything, and part of me felt like it gave people an option to buy something that was less expensive. And I like going through those racks when I go to an exhibition or an art fair. I like looking through the rack. But I'm not sure now, if I was doing it again, if I would put a rack there.
Do you know what I've often experienced with the racks is that sometimes people use going through the rack as a physical, easy thing to do to stay on your stand while actually they're thinking about something else.
They want to leave, but they don't want to look like they're rushing off.
No, more like they're actually got their eye on that painting over there.
Oh,
and they don't want to make it obvious quite yet that they've got their eye on that painting over there, because they're not quite ready to be involved in a conversation. But they will stand and go through the rack as an excuse to stand and look out of the corner of their eye until they're ready to say to you, actually, that one over there, could I buy that one, please? So I think the racks do, yeah, they do definitely have a purpose if you're there as well. So we're talking then about, there's different stages of this, aren't there, about whether you are hanging at a show, at a space. So if you've got something that you're planning for, the first thing is work out the space. You know, have a look at the space, draw it up, see how much space you've got, because that will really help to give you an idea. And if you can, if you've got the space, what I find really useful is, because sometimes people find it hard to visualize, so I draw up like a mini small scale version on the computer. Some people print them out and they like shuffling it around with bits of paper. But it can also help physically.
Sorry, I sneezed, everybody. Sorry. It can also help physically. Yeah. So.
But it can also help physically to get your paintings out and lay them on the floor if you've got a space, to see what the spacing should be. Like, because sometimes if you're doing it on a small scale plan, 20 centimetres, 30 centimetres, 40 centimetres between a painting isn't very much on the plan. But in reality, you just have a feel of how close things should or shouldn't be. But that's when you've got to the stage of framing it. And I think actually this goes back even further to what you as an artist should be doing in the studio while you're working, which is always building in that curation of your work in terms of the choices that you're making. And I think if you do that as part of your creative practice, it doesn't feel so sudden to suddenly kind of do it at the end. It's almost too late at that point.
Yeah. Do you think, though, if you've done it effectively during the making of a series of work, that then you shouldn't need to do much curating if you're going to exhibit it, because you've already done it?
I would hope so, yeah. But I would also, I mean, if you've done it as part of your practice as you're going through, there will be that, I think you'll know much more easily, yeah, this deserves its place as part of this group of work. And this was something that was an exploratory piece that got me there, that yes, that might be of interest, but it needs to be displayed in a different way because people might be interested in it, but it doesn't have to be on show.
That happened with my book. So it was really interesting when I got, so we had 35 paintings and I'd already curated a couple out myself, thought, no, I don't think they belong. We had 35 and I got the proof, which comes as a PDF these days. And I was going through the PDF and there was one that just stood out like a sore thumb, that it didn't belong. And there is a group of paintings which are quite different in style because they relate to a specific poem. I was all right with that, with those. But this one was like, no, that needs to go. And so I had to take it out. And then I've had to go through all the proofs of the book and change it to 35 paintings to 34 paintings, or 30 plus I think we put, because it's no longer 35 and I don't have another one to fill it in that would be good enough. So it was interesting, and I think the same thing probably happens at an exhibition. If you're lucky enough to have one of those big spaces where you hang all your work and look at it, you probably can see very easily then, oh, that one I loved, it doesn't belong with these others. It might go somewhere else, but it doesn't belong here.
Yeah, which then brings the question up, what do you do with work? So is it okay to have work, or how do you display work that is has its own merit, is relevant, is, you know, it's not a question of quality in that sense, but it just doesn't happen to go with that group. And I think sometimes it is about giving it a little bit more breathing space. So often at an exhibition, you do have a wall that is a little bit more independent. So you can hang it on there, but it's unlikely that there's a painting that's a real one-off. Sometimes you get them. I've had them. That really bright green one was a one-off.
Yeah.
But there are usually things within it that do link with your work in other ways. But yeah, it just comes down to how does it feel together? And if you hang it and it feels off, take it out.
Yeah. And it is a feeling. It's a literal, I went through the book the first time and I thought, oh no. And I flicked past trying to ignore the feeling, like, no, it'll be fine. But then every time I looked at it, it was like, no, it definitely isn't fine. It just stands out like a sore thumb. And I really think it would to anyone else. I don't think it's just me. So curating, we are saying, Ben, are we saying that less is more and that you do need to curate?
I'm not sure that it's necessarily that less is more is always the answer, because sometimes it can be that, you know, they're all valid, but it's just a question of how you choose to display them. And in that case, if you are limited on space, then yeah, maybe you've just got more work than fits within that space, but you're not necessarily doing yourself any favors by cramming them all in just to have them up there.
Yeah.
But I think you do need to make that decision about your work and what contributes to the whole. And this comes right back down to what's important to you as an artist. Is it just doing the work and putting it all out without having any understanding of it yourself? I just think that it's so built into the process of doing it. It's just an automatic part of it for me. I'm just trying to think while I'm doing this, do I have any paintings that never made the cut? I think if I have paintings that I feel have never made the cut, they don't even leave the studio yet. So they don't even get to the stage where I'm wondering about how to hang them.
Yeah, I think for me, usually that's the case. Or if it does escape, like that one did, and then I see it and realize, no, it doesn't fit, what will happen to that is I will eventually sand it down and paint over it. I won't, it's too much of a one-off. It was me experimenting with a different way of expressing this feeling I was trying to get, but it's the only one I did in that experimentational style, and yeah, it doesn't feel like me. It feels a bit forced, a bit contrived. And even also, though that wasn't my feeling when I made it, but it does.
It might not have been your feeling when you made it, but if you said it was the only one that I did in that style, if it had felt right, you'd have done more of those, and then it exactly wouldn't have been the only one, would it?
Exactly. So you're right. So usually for me, what happens is they get painted over. I use them again. I don't, you know, it's not wasted, but it's definitely never going to see the light of day, that one. But you might have one like that that is an outlier. We've talked about this before, and it's the lead into the next series of work. Yes. You do, because you're very excited by it. So yeah, then it might belong with the next series.
Yeah. And I think in that sense, you know, if the question is, do I hang and display everything that I've just finished or everything that I've made? No, sometimes you want to keep things. You want to keep things because they're still part of your learning experience. They're still part of something that's triggered something in you. You need to kind of look and absorb from that. And it can be really helpful to keep those paintings hanging around. And yes, if you want to sell, that can be a difficult thing too. You know, to say, actually, no, I'm not going to make that one available for sale yet. I need to keep it.
I think one other thing I want to mention as well, when we're talking about this and websites, when you're curating, let's say you are a person who paints florals and portraits and landscapes and abstracts. And you want all those on your website, I really think you need to curate them into separate collections on the website so that people come in, have some sense of navigating through that. Because if I come to your website and there's an abstract next to a portrait, next to a bowl of fruit, I just don't know what to look at again. But if I see that you've organized them for me, then I can click on what interests me. And I might go back and look at the other things, but at least, again, it's a cohesive story as I look at them, not a mishmash of different things.
Yeah, and this is just part of you discovering what direction you want to go on as an artist. And I think if there are too many options and too many routes, then it serves you better to take a step back and think, which one of these do I really want to develop? And that doesn't mean to say that you stop experimenting and you stop working in different ways or on different subjects. It just means that you stand back and you think, okay, what is the thread here? And because it can be subject, it can be color, it can be medium, there are so many variables across all of these. But like, you like working with limited color palette to some degree, that's just a way of taking some of the options out. So it's easier for people to see the things that you do want them to pay attention to in your work.
But for Sarah, the big exhibition with lots and lots of paintings, everyone's done that. So we don't mean this to sound like we're saying, oh, well, that was wrong, because who knows if it was wrong. Alice hasn't even seen it. I've only seen one photo, which I can't find now. It may not have been wrong, but thank you for sparking this discussion, because it's one that we haven't had before, and I think it's helpful to everybody to think about. So thank you.
Yeah, and just different ways to group your work. There are lots of different ways of doing it. And I think if you get somebody else involved whose opinion that you trust, what might come out of that is that somebody else sees links in your work that perhaps you don't see because you're too close for it. And I think that can create some quite interesting conversations. What I'm looking for when I display work together is a way to create those links and conversations between paintings that exist, so that when people look at the group as a whole, they understand what it is I'm trying to do in my work. And I think that whole relationship of what you're interested in individual paintings and how they relate to each other is something that's really interesting in a group of work, and it's something that you have as a real advantage when you have the opportunity to show your work all together. And it's a massive thing to be able to learn from, to stand back as an artist, because usually when we're working on our pieces, they're in the studio, you don't necessarily have time to have them or space to have them all up together. So to learn from looking at your work together as a whole when it's on display somewhere has always been really, really valuable for me to do. And what one of the things that makes standing in front of your own work at an art fair all weekend worthwhile is that you actually have that time to appreciate it and look at it together and understand it a little bit more for the work that you go on to do afterwards. Okay, so what are you bringing to the table this week on Little Inspirations?
Well, it's not so much inspiration as enjoyed and negative inspiration. So everybody knows that I don't watch TV really. I watch the odd show. And if something's really good, Mayor of Easttown. Oh my God, that's so good.
Is that the one with Kate Winslet?
Yeah.
I can't get it. It's on Sky, isn't it?
Good. Yes, it's on Now TV.
Okay.
Anyway, that's really good. But if something's really good, I'll watch it. But otherwise, I really don't watch much TV. And I got into, on Amazon Prime, watching Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, no.
Which has about 17 seasons, I think.
Yes.
And I started season one, and I don't even know why I went down this rabbit hole. I think I heard people talking about it on the radio, and I was like, oh, that'll be something to put on when I've got nothing to do. Like, I'm already on season four, and I'm mainlining them, and I'm like not able to stop. And it's clearly manipulative soap opera. It's clearly like every time you think a storyline ends, another one picks up so that you are hooked in. Alice is nodding like, oh yeah, been there, done that. So So I'm just completely embroiled. And every time I put one on, I feel like, you know, like someone with an eating disorder who's got the chocolate out again. It's like, put it away. It's not doing you any good. Adding nothing to your life. It's adding nothing to the world for you to watch a program that, when was it, the series I'm on was recorded in like 2007 or something.
Yeah.
So anybody who's,
that's your guilty pleasure, very guilty
who
pleasure,
has not started Grey's Anatomy, don't, just don't, because you won't be able to stop.
The reason that I'm laughing is we started watching it as something that we could watch with my daughter. She, when she was at that, you know, 14, 15 age, where it's kind of like difficult to find something that's interesting without being, you know, too much or too childish. And so we started watching it together, and then she did exactly what you did. And then we realized that she was like three seasons ahead. It's like, that's not the point. The point is that we do it together. She's like, yeah, but you're so slow.
I know. And I want to know what happens with these characters, but then you realize it never ends. So literally, there used to be something called General Hospital in America, which was like our Coronation Street. It had been running forever and ever and ever. It was on in the daytime though. And people would be obsessed with that. And this is that, only higher class with better actors. It's just soap opera. That's all it is.
And because it's been running for such a long time, what was so funny was, like, so I maybe gave up watching it about possibly, I don't know, season whatever, 3, 4, 5, whatever. And then every so often I would come back into the sitting room and she would be on a much later season and everybody is 12 years older, or you say something and she's like, oh no, he died. Oh, she died. And then because she went back to rerun them, I'm like, well, hang on a minute, I thought she died. And she's like, no, I'm watching an earlier one again. So everything was hopping around all over the place. But yeah, no, it's a good series.
It's good fun. But I don't recommend that rabbit hole. So what about you?
I'm going to recommend something that I've been listening to on YouTube. Actually, I haven't had so much problem with this lately, the getting to sleep or the waking up in the middle of the night thing, possibly because I'm having a little bit of estrogen gel that's helping with that. Too much information, but there we go. It is helping with that. But Jason Stevenson on YouTube does some really, really good guided sleep meditations, and I never make it anywhere near the end. I'm always asleep within 15 minutes. He has a lovely Australian voice, and I am lulled to sleep like a baby, but they're good enough so that I think, actually, I kind of quite want to hear what you're saying and where this is going. So I might, even at some point, I always think, oh, it'd be nice to listen to these during the day when I don't actually go to sleep.
And just don't do it while you're in the car.
No. And then I never have time during the day to, to do it. But if anything, I think it's made me think, yeah, it would be quite nice to bring some of this a little bit into my daily waking hours, not just the going to sleep hours. But I don't know. Can you see me as somebody who actually starts doing meditation?
Well, I don't know. I've been thinking about it too. I listened to this podcast with Lee Mack. Do you know Lee Mack, the comedian? And his friend, who's a TV producer, and it's called I Can't Believe It's Not Buddha. And they are, his friend is into Buddhism and meditation, and he got Lee Mack into meditation. And if anyone in America doesn't, if you don't know Lee Mack, he's just a comedian. He's the absolute last person you would imagine doing meditation. He's kind of the, who was that? Louis C.K. of British TV is kind of that. And he's really into it. And he now meditates twice for 20 minutes a day. And he's starting to think about doing retreats. And it's a comedy. They're always giggling on the podcast, so it annoys me a bit because they never get into a conversation without giggling. But if someone like him can get into it, he was the last person I would imagine, then I should imagine you could. And he says it's really changed his life.
And I can well believe that. And I can believe all of these things. I think the thing for me is that sort of moment between sleep and wakefulness has always been really important for me. And I think I don't know enough about it, so I'm going to sound like an idiot, but those kind of different brain waves that happen when you're at those different consciousness states, I really enjoy. And I wonder if that's almost what I access, because I can do lucid dreaming. And I just wonder if that's a similar thing, but you're just doing it in a different state. So yeah, something else to explore and investigate. We'll see. I'm going to be inundated now, aren't I, with suggestions of where to try.
Yeah.
Where to try meditation. I just can't see when it will happen in my day. That's a poor excuse, isn't it?
I heard someone who meditates a lot say, people say to me, how do you find an hour a day to meditate? And I say, how do you not?
Yes.
Because he said he gets so much more done.
Yes.
Because he meditates for an hour a day. So
I think that is a piss poor excuse on my part. So I'm not making any promises. Let's see.
Don't jump into an hour a day though. That'd be
No, I'm not going to jump in. I think even if you did 10 minutes, but let's see. Right, that wraps it up then from us this week. So whether meditation inspiration is your thing, or if you're looking for something else to kind of kickstart you, it is not too late to join Louise's free course. It has started, but you still have time to catch up, to do the exercises, to join in and to see what that brings you. So the best way to do that is to go to her website, louisefletcherart.com, and look under the four artists section, where you'll be able to see all the information for the taster course for Find Your Joy. And we will see you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.